Meet John Falk, Al, from New York City.
How are you all? It's customary, I know, to identify yourself and give your credentials for appearing before such a group. I'd like to give you an objective statement about my right to be here. Some years ago, when Charlie Jackson's book, The Lost Weekend, was made into a motion picture, with some trepidation, I took my wife to see it. I suffered through the picture, as all of us, I think, who have seen it did, reliving many of the experiences which the mythical character Don Burnham had therein. My wife didn't say anything. When we got out, I didn't say anything for a while. We walked along the street. And finally, I summoned up my courage and I said to her, "Well, honey, what'd you think about it?" She gave one of those wifely sniffs and said, "That guy wasn't even drunk." Shortly after I joined AA, I took my father, who was a Presbyterian clergyman, to his first meeting. And after the meeting was over, during the coffee and donut hour, we became separated, and one of the eager beavers in the group hustled up to Father and said, "Do you have an alcoholic problem?" Father said, "Yes, indeed, there he is." He pointed out. So I think you'll agree that I qualify. Of course, it's pleasant to be back here again. Some of my friends in New Orleans were reminding me of the hassle I found myself in up to my armpits the first time I ventured down to this city in behalf of AA. And I'm very glad that there were at least no resentments lingering, at least no open ones, so that I could come back and be with you tonight on this 21st conference meeting. You've heard the reading of selection from chapter 5, in which frank, open, unabashed statement is made that recovery is possible by adherence to the program. We can talk all we wish about the fellowship of AA, which is very real and very wonderful and fills this room tonight with warmth and happiness. We can talk about the wisdom we get about alcoholism as we explore our own experiences and listen to those of our friends. But the simple truth, as we heard tonight, rarely do people fail who attempt to live by the program. Consequently, I am going to talk to you tonight about my understanding of the program. I think the capacity for self-torture that exists among AA members is astounding. They have a fancy name for it. They call it masochism. I think no less than 30 to 35 people have already bustled up to me at one time or other since I arrived this morning and said, "We've heard your tape on the 12 steps, and we want you to do it again tonight." I don't imagine, Mr. Jones, that too often people say to you that, "We've heard a tape of your sermon, will you please preach it again?" This is not a tribute to me, of course. It is a tribute to the validity of the statement read to us tonight that we stay sober by adherence to the program. And while the language of the steps remains the same, happily, down through the years, although people like me have spoken about this for a good many years, each of us, as we speak or read or listen, constantly finds something new. New light is cast on matters which have been obscure. Problems which seem to defy solution suddenly become plain. Behavior of our own selves and behavior of others, which has mystified us, becomes crystal clear. And so, despite the fact that many of you, perhaps too many of you, have heard me hold forth on the 12 steps, you're all going to have to listen again, although I won't be heard if anybody leaves at this point. Shall I stop to let you retire? The one thing I would emphasize, which I think always needs to be said, is that there is no party line, there is no dogma, there is no creed, there is no official interpretation of the AA steps to which your adherence is required. There are no spokesmen for AA, and the minute we get an AA spokesman, we're in trouble. Our basic strength rests in the fact that each of us, if we are to stay sober, each of us hammers out for himself an understanding of the 12 steps, which makes it possible for him to work with them, to follow them, and hence maintain sobriety. So what I am going to say to you tonight is one man's opinion. If it has appealed to you, I'll be grateful. And I hope that perhaps it will add a little bit to your own thinking and understanding of our steps. In preface, let me say two things. First of all, there is the pronoun, we, which appears constantly at the beginning of each step. We do this, we do that. And so we do because we are all in this together and we meet in groups and we meet in conferences like this, and occasionally every 5 years we gather in a great international association meeting. But actually, the program is I. No one else can take this program for me. No one can understand it for me. Nobody can wrestle with it for me. I can ask other people's advice. I can read and seek enlightenment of what others think about it. But in the last analysis, my sobriety depends on my own study and work, perseverance with the program. The second point is one which perhaps will be slightly more contentious, and that is the order in which the steps are arranged. I have heard, and doubtless you have heard, speakers in AA say it doesn't make any particular difference in what order you take the steps, and if a step bothers you, just skip it and go on to another. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this is each person's right to hold this view, but I quarrel with this. And I will try to show you tonight that, to me, the successful adherence to the program is very largely dependent on taking the steps in the order in which they appear. This order has its own logic, and it is very difficult, as I'm going to try to show you tonight, to jump a step and hope to have a great deal of success with the ones which follow the one you have omitted. With this out of the way, let's begin with number one. Now, I've never heard anybody in AA say you can skip number one. As a matter of fact, there is no program of therapy in vogue anywhere in the world to which I have knowledge that does not begin with the first step or its equivalent phrased in other language. I admit I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life has become unmanageable. It's a strange thing and a rather wonderful thing that a nation which believes in success, where a book entitled The Power of Positive Thinking has sold in countless editions, that our success rests on our flat statement about the most negative thing a man can say about himself. I'm beaten. I'm licked. I'm powerless. Not until I can do this is there real hope for my recovery. I also suggest an amplification of the word admit. Now, perhaps many of you may be bugged by this a little bit, but just let me say in extenuation that I've spent all my life using words, and words have different shades of meaning to me, which are quite important. The word admit to me is an expression of a cerebral action, an action of the thought. A man stands up, as I am doing tonight, and may give his own life story. And the person listening to him identifies with the speaker. He thinks through his own life and comparing the two, the account he has heard from the platform and his own experience, he comes to the conclusion that they match up, and so he says, I admit that I'm an alcoholic. The thought process is involved, and very important too. But the word has another connotation. One time in my career, I was a newspaper man. And I wrote, I don't know how many stories, to the effect that Joe Blow was arrested by the police last night in the vicinity of a store which had been robbed, and after questioning at police headquarters, quote, admitted, end quote, he had committed the crime. You know, and I know, frequently in police stations, a great deal of pressure is applied to those who are arrested. And the admission is not a joyful, happy act. It is something which is wrung out of the reluctant victim. And isn't this what often happens to us? Our drinking backs us into a corner. We keep saying, oh, I can drink if this or if that, or I had some bad ginger ale, or the ice was bad, or... But finally, our defenses are down, we're cornered, and we throw up our hands and say, all right, I admit I'm an alcoholic. But something else is necessary, and that is the development of an attitude toward this fact. You know, we talk a great deal in AA of the danger to our sobriety of resentment. And yet the most dangerous resentment of all which alcoholics hold is the resentment of their alcoholism. Their resentment that they cannot drink. I say to myself, do you mean to say that I can't drink and my wife can? Do you mean to say this stupid guy in the office who doesn't earn as much money as I do and doesn't have as good a house or a car, he can drink and I can't? My kids can drink and I can't? All these other dopes at parties can drink and I can't? And we build up a long bit of woe about it and bury ourselves in self-pity. We are resenting the fact that we cannot drink. And this is why I suggest when you're thinking about the first step, you add to the word admit the word accept. Because accept is a voluntary act. You cannot force anybody to accept something. It is an expression of an attitude, of a feeling. The point which we all sooner or later must reach when we say, not only I admit I'm an alcoholic, I accept the fact. And this is one of the basic points of the prayer which is repeated over and over again, the prayer for serenity to accept the things we cannot change, including our alcoholism. And I'm convinced with talks with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of alcoholics who've had the unfortunate experience of having had slips, that many times the slip stems from the partial following of the first step, not the total process. Adding to admission of alcoholism, acceptance of the fact. One of our very great and good friends, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, a psychiatrist from Connecticut, and one of the first of his profession to understand alcoholism truly, has described this in a professional paper written for his fellow psychiatrist as the surrender process in AA. He was a professional man. who has had great skill in helping people with all kinds of emotional problems. And he recognizes the basic soundness of step number one and the fact that it is a prerequisite to recovery. He says, as a professional man, I can do nothing for an alcoholic who does not experience this surrender process. If you think back in your life, don't you remember a certain period when all of a sudden you had an enormous sense of relief that you didn't have to fight this thing anymore? It wasn't just that the nagging desire to have a drink left, but that your attitude, you suddenly realized, had changed. And you were no longer bugged by alcohol. You were no longer anxious about it. You no longer really feared it, because you had accepted the fact that you couldn't drink. Number two, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Mind you, you can't stop with step one. Step one is just diagnosis of what's wrong. Diagnosis not followed by therapy or action is worthless. It may help you to know what you died of, but you're dead. You must immediately move from diagnosis to doing something about it. You had said in the first step, powerless. Logic would compel me then, if I have admitted that I am powerless, to find a source of power which will enable me to live again. And so I come to believe that there is a power, not within me, not part of me, outside of me and far greater, which can restore me to what? Sobriety? No, the word is sanity. Why do you suppose the men who wrote these steps used that word? Well, I suggest, and I don't know this, but it seems to me that perhaps they were using sanity in its widest sense, not just in contradistinction to insanity, but sanity in the sense of its root meaning, wholeness. Read it this way. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could make me whole again. If anything is typical of our experience at alcoholism, it is the shattering effect that it has on our lives. We are torn apart. We fight inside ourselves. Pull this way, pull that way. We feel there is something missing. We struggle for completion. Often this has been one of the reasons, although we didn't understand, that we were drinking. We were looking for this sense of being a whole, complete person again. So the step says to me, there is a power, if I can come to believe it, which can make me whole again. Now, you don't dare stop here either, because you've had your diagnosis. And you know the answer, if you stop there, you're still going to get drunk. You're like a man who suddenly realizes he's been living in a dark house. Somebody tells him there's an electric power plant down the street which will supply power to make the lights go on. And just as long as he knows it's down the street and doesn't do anything about it, he's still in dark when the sun goes down. So you must. You must move on to number three. I make a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God as I understand it. My life is powerless, unmanageable. I come to believe there is a power. I make a decision to try to bring this power into my life, to make me whole, to make my life manageable, to restore me to sanity. As I look at these steps, these three seem to me the great steps of initiation into AA. These are the three which lead us into the fellowship. We immediately go on to lay the foundation for the future life of sobriety, which we all seek so earnestly. I make a searching and fearless moral inventory. Here again, you see the process, how this cycle keeps repeating itself. Diagnosis first. I take a look at myself for the first time with clear eyes. No more looking at myself through the bottom of a glass. No more the self-delusion which alcohol makes so easily possible. Although I cannot, as no human being can be, totally objective about myself, I try for the first time, probably in years, to stop kidding myself and see what kind of a person I have become, the kind of a person whose life has been turned over to God in an urgent call for help, an attempt to assay the material with which he and I are going to have to work. Now, my friends, don't stop here. Because I do know men who have stopped. And they were so shattered by the picture they saw of themselves for the first time in their lives that they couldn't stand it and went out and got drunk. You must make the inventory as honest and as searching and as fearless as possible, but do not be dismayed. Steps follow which enable you to deal with the things which you uncover, often to your horror and dismay. I admit to God, to myself, and to some other human being exactly what I've found in the inventory. The idea of admitting it to God is not strange to most of us. It's difficult. Sometimes frightening, but we can. Some people are puzzled by the part of admitting it to ourselves. You say, well, I wrote the inventory. Isn't this admitting it to myself? No, I don't think quite so. There's a psychological difference from my writing down something about myself, such as John Lee is a very impatient guy, and admitting to myself that what I wrote here was quite correct. And we all know the value that comes from being able to talk frankly with a trusted friend about the problems which beset us. In recent years, I've been fascinated by the writings of a clergyman who is also a psychologist. And he has been a very severe critic of Freudian psychology in many of its aspects. And he points to AA as having discovered or rediscovered a basic truth. And the health, he says, of the men and women in AA lies in this step, in their ability to confess to each other these things which have made them feel guilty and in effect receive from their fellow members of AA acceptance and forgiveness. This man agrees that AA is right when it says, of course we did wrong. Of course we did things that hurt people. We don't tell anybody in AA that this was unimportant. But we offer a way of dealing with these things which eases the burden of guilt which has been crushing us during the period of our active drinking. But you can't stop just with this step either. You have to get release for the things which you have admitted to God, to yourself, and to some other human being. And so the next two steps come along. Now, when I was greener in AA, and I looked at these two steps, I said to myself, aha, the fellows that wrote this program ended up with 11 steps, so they didn't think that sounded very good, so they made it an even dozen, because this step says the same thing. But I don't think so anymore. There's a profound, and don't let this word frighten you, there's a profound theological truth involved in the separation of these steps. I become willing to have God deal with my defects of character. And then I ask him to do so. This is an expression in the language of our group of what the theologian calls the doctrine of free will. That God isn't going to do anything for us that we don't really want him to do. I've rarely met anybody in AA who's a little bit skeptical at first about what so many people call the God angle. I think it must amuse the deity immensely to be referred to as an angle, but I'm sure he's so pleased that we're coming back to him that it doesn't bother him. But these fellows say, I did pray. I prayed all the time and nothing happened. Well, if you prayed the way I did, you usually said, God, get me out of this one and I'll be a good boy. The classic example of this is St. Augustine's famous prayer. Before he became a saint, Augustine, who was a wealthy young man in the 5th century living in North Africa, was quite a riff. And he became impressed with the evil ways of his life, and he thought he'd change them. And he's reported to have prayed, "Oh God, make me chaste," but not right away. Nothing, of course, happened. This step made it possible for me to understand why so many of my prayers seemed to me to be answered. The Lord was listening to what I wanted, not to what I was saying. There's not a bit of sense in our asking him to do something about a defective character we've discovered in our lives unless we're willing to pay the price which is involved in its removal. Now, many of us, men particularly, travel on expense accounts. And I expect there is more money stolen through padding expense accounts than almost any kind of white-collar larceny. But sometimes we will come to see this as larceny and we'll ask that God make us honest. But until we're willing to give up what we've been buying through the proceeds of this stealing, nothing is going to happen. We must prepare to be greatly surprised by the way our prayers are answered. The late Peter Marshall, I'm sure many of you have read the books about him which his wife has written, preached a sermon on the perils of prayer. And he told about a businessman whose besetting sin, like mine, was impatience. I don't mean to be proud and say this is the only one I've got. But one of his besetting sins was impatience. And he asked, he was sincere in his desire to be made patient, and about 2 days later, his secretary was driving him wild. And he was about to blow his top when suddenly he realized perhaps he was being taught patience. I become willing to have God remove these defects of character and ask him to do so. These two are inextricably intertwined. How can you skip one and go to the other? We also have hurt other people. We leave quite a swath of destruction behind us. We owe everybody who we've been able to persuade to lend us money. We've offended many people personally. We have given our bosses, or if we are a boss ourselves, have given our associates and employees a very bad time. And this too cumbers our spirit. Here again, the AA program does not attempt to deny the reality of the harm and hurt we have caused, but gives us a way of dealing with the guilt which our behavior has caused us. I make a list of those who I have harmed, become willing, this process against, become willing to make amends, and then do it. In other words, it has to be genuine. It isn't a perfunctory apology as when you bump into somebody on the street. It's got to be genuine and sincere to have any lasting effect. If you told Bill he was a lousy so-and-so and you still think he is, don't bother going and telling him you were sorry, he said, because it's meaningless. But you and I all know the great delight and joy and freedom, really, that these two steps give us. If you were anything like me, you spent your life avoiding people. When I was living in Philadelphia, my passage down the main street was a kind of a zigzag. As I saw people I owed money to or I caused trouble to, and I was always ducking out of their way. Now, not that I have become perfect, but I've done what I could to tell these people of my genuine sorrow and contrition for what I have done. I have asked their forgiveness, and almost universally, I've received it. If it hasn't been forthcoming, at least I've done my share. Now, these six steps, it seems to me, as I said at the outset, are the foundation for our future life in AA. They're the clearing away of the debris, the accumulation of the anguish and the sorrow and the guilt of the past years, the attempt to make it possible for us to live again with ourselves, with God, and with our fellow men, so that we're then able to embark on the rest of our lives as sober citizens. Some people wonder, when they come in AA, they expect they're going to stay around for a little while, but the thought of AA meetings the rest of their lives seems to be somewhat horrible. And I know this is true because when I was working in the clinic and I talked to men who came in for help, thought they'd be in AA, had been in AA, I'd say to them, well, why did you leave? And they wouldn't want to hurt my feelings. They'd hem and haw and talk around the bush. And I'd finally say, well, now, come on, tell me. And they'd say, well, frankly, John, I got bored. I said, bored? They said, yes. I got so I knew everybody's story in AA better than my own. That's all it was, night after night. Drunken experiences. Unfortunately, this is sometimes the case, isn't it? The value of the personal experience is twofold. First, it provides immense catharsis and relief for the person telling it. In the early days, this is essential. For a man who has felt that he was a louse, a no-good bum, a person held in universal contempt because of what he's done, to be able to stand before a group of people and say all these things and receive not scorn, not contempt, not reprobation, but acceptance, does something tremendous for the human spirit. And the second reason, of course, is for the benefit of the new people who are coming, that they may hear it firsthand from those who have been through the hell of alcoholism what it is really like, to enable them to identify, as I said earlier, with our program. But this is not the whole of AA. And if you will look with me now, and you can't get out of it, I guess, at this late date, if you will look at me now at the last three steps, I am convinced that none of you will ever leave AA because you were bored. The ninth step. I continue to take inventory. And then this wonderful preservative of sobriety, when I am wrong, promptly admit it. You know, we talk a lot about 12-step work. 10th-step work is pretty vital, too. This is a recognition that we are human. It is a recognition that the enlightenment and the excitement and the stimulus of our early days when we think everybody in AA is an angel and there is nobody in the world like these wonderful drunks, this passes. We find out that our sponsor puts on his pants one leg at a time like everybody else. We find out that our sponsor can get mad. We find that sometimes he's reluctant to go out on 12-step calls. In other words, we find he's a human being, and this strangely comes as a shock. But it's essential. Until we understand what it means to be a human being, we're never going to stay sober. You know, they talk a great deal about the emotional immaturity of alcoholics. And it is true, at least seems to me, that many of us were. In one particular aspect of life, I guess you've been to AA meetings where a fellow stands up and says, before I came in AA, I was an idealist. And the implication is, once he came in AA, he dumped his ideals overboard. Well, this isn't what he means. It's a problem of semantics. What the fellow means is, before I came in AA, I was a utopian, which is something quite different. A utopian is an immature person who believes that people can be 100% perfect. And finding out that neither he nor his friends or associates were 100% perfect became a cynic, junior grade. During the war, there was a wonderful cartoon that at least went all over the Navy. Perhaps it went through the Army, too. It was done by Stieg, and it showed a dour little old man sitting in a box. The caption underneath it said, "People are no damn good." Isn't this the attitude many of us had when we came into AA? But through this ninth step, if we follow it, as we regard ourselves, as we see ourselves with the best intentions of the world making the most horrible bloomers, with the best intentions of the world hurting people that we didn't want to hurt, with the best intentions of the world doing foolish and stupid things, we come to understand this mystery of our humanity. That we are not good or evil totally. That no one is black or white, but we are an amazing mixture of black and white, of strengths and weaknesses, of capacities and failures. If you'll pardon me for slipping into the language with which I'm familiar because of Father, it was expressed beautifully by a man named Paul a good many years ago, where he said, all, and he included himself, all fall short of the glory of God. The things that I would do, I don't do, and the things I shouldn't, I do. Here was a man we call saint, but who saw very clearly the nature of his own humanity and the fact that he and no other human being could be perfect. Now, this study of self is not to be confused with egotism. It is not sitting and examining yourself to the exclusion of your responsibilities to your family, to your job, to your community, to your country. But it's a recognition that if you and I do nothing about the life which is entrusted to us, nobody is. And the only hope we have of helping others is to be as good ourselves, as strong as possible, as intelligent as possible, as faithful as possible. And the willingness to admit error is one of the great safety valves against resentment. You know, it's a queer thing about human beings. We love people we do things for, And we can come to hate people we've hurt. You ever played football? You slug the fellow in the line opposite you, and you just wait and wait and wait and wait for him to slug back, and finally you get furious at the guy. He hasn't done anything. You hit him. But your own feeling of having done something wrong to him makes you project that on him. And he becomes, in truth, your enemy. But when we hurt people, and the sooner the better, that we say, I'm sorry, the easier our life becomes, and we are saved from any aspect of conscious virtue, which, as you all know, is unbearable to everybody around us. This is the way of keeping ourselves sweet and clean. The 11th step, I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious knowledge of God as I understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will and for the strength to carry it out. This is the one we like to skip over because it sounds too much like a Methodist prayer meeting. Here's some more of this God business right out in the open. But I didn't write this program. Men who got sober before I came along did. And it stays in because deep down we know the source of the power we discovered in steps 2 and 3. We know that we are sober not through our own wisdom, not through our own strength, not through our own virtue, but through this power which has been released in our lives in a wonderful way through our association with our friends in AA. You don't believe, do you, that these people are lying or hypocritical when they stand up before a group night after night and say, I'm here tonight thanks to the grace of God in AA? Do you believe this is just meaningless talk? Well, if this is true, mustn't we try to find out all we can about this grace which has been released in our lives, has made it possible for us to have, in fact, new life, to live as we are living, to know the joys and the happiness and the contentment which sobriety has brought us. There is no subject on which men have written more, studied more, or thought more in all of recorded history than the nature of God. This has always absorbed man, puzzled him, intrigued him, fascinated him. And despite all that has been written and said and studied and known, there is still a vast mystery which none of us will ever know until we move on into another life. But it also stands to reason, as we listen to people who have been studying and who have been thinking, who have been reading, and whose lives are a living testimony that something has happened to them as a result of this concern, that there's value in it. As a matter of fact, as you listen to people talking about their experiences in AA, you begin to have a pretty good idea of how they understand God. And you begin to understand why they speak of his grace. Grace, you know, is something freely given. It's not something that can be earned. There is none of us, no matter how good or noble or perfect we think we are, who really deserves that God should do anything for him at all. But the amazing thing with which we are all witnesses here tonight is that he does. He apparently, for some inscrutable reason known only to him, loves drunks. That he is not angry. That he has not been blasting us or destroying us. But as we discover, he has been waiting for us to turn to him all the time. An AA group thinking about things like this is not likely to get bored because it's an absorbing, stimulating subject. Finally, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, I carry the message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, it seems somehow as though the average AA person drops the first and the last clause, and all he sees in the 12th step is the message. But the first clause is the one that's the answer to this question I told you about taking the steps in order. There is no message until you've had an experience as a result of the preceding steps. You know, in another part of the country, which will be nameless, but whose initials are Texas, I understand they have some people they call two-steppers. These are people who take the first step and immediately put on their fireman's hat and go out to save the world from alcohol. And they wonder why nobody stays sober. What is our message? It's not just that alcoholism is an illness, although this is part of it. There was a time when hardly anybody else in the country but alcoholics were saying this. But happily now, the American Medical Association has accepted the fact of alcoholism. Every county medical society is supposed to have a committee on alcoholism. The church, which in all its branches, in all the faiths, has been slow to understand this, now does, and realizes that alcoholics present a peculiar problem in the use of beverage alcohol, and even the dry churches, such as the Methodist Church, have stimulated programs. I guess I should put dry in quotes. We've got four Methodist ministers in the southern section of Virginia AA. But anyhow, the official position of the church is dry. Now, this amuses us, but to me as an alcoholic, it's simply wonderful that while still clinging to their belief in total abstinence as a more Christian way of life, they have come to grasp the fact of alcoholism and are saying to their ministers and their people, the pastoral care and concern of the church must never be withdrawn from people because they drink. You and I have had a part in bringing about this change of view in the churches, and we should be grateful for it. But my point is that the world is no longer dependent on us to get the word that alcoholics are sick people. Nor is our message that alcoholics do strange things when they get drunk. This is hardly a startling fact, and the world is quite well aware of it, whether we tell it or not. The message we have, and this I believe is one we must never forget, is that alcoholics don't have to go on drinking. That this disease, this condition, this affliction, call it what you will, that had been accepted in our country for generations and generations as virtually hopeless, where the recovery rate was less than 2%, no matter what procedure of therapy you followed, we have now reached the amazing scientific fact that doctors, not just we laymen, but doctors proclaim from the platform that alcoholics don't have to go on drinking, and you and I have a way which will make it possible for them to become sober. This is the message. And where do we get it? We get it from the 12th step. This is why chapter 5 says, rarely have we seen a person fail who follows our program. We say to an alcoholic, you want to stop drinking? Our answer is not just to tell him to come to meetings and be friendly with us. You say, of course, there are a lot of us who want to help you, and you can count on us for anything, but here, my friend, is the way we stayed sober. Take a look at it. This is what we recommend. And there's that final kicker. I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. What principles? There's not a single principle written in the AA program, to be sure. Principles implicit. But the AA program is not a statement of principles, it's a statement of methods, resting on certain principles, and it's up to you, and it's up to me, and it's up to our groups to continually explore, discover what these principles are. And this is the assurance of our continuing sobriety. You know, AAs, most of us are very resentful of being called reformers. Because reform to the average person means somebody who's trying to pass a law to take away something else that we don't care about doing from somebody who wants to do it. In this sense, we are not reformers, but in the basic meaning of the word, there is no group in the country that is creating more reform in lives of men and women than we are doing. We're making men and women tear up their lives by their roots. We're causing them to make a sharp about face, to choose new values, to head on new headings, to become different people. In a sense, I suppose we might be sued for false pretenses. We get people into AA, we tell them to stop drinking, and actually, we're getting them in there to change their lives. And we all know that if we just come in to stay sober is all right, but if that's what we stay in to accomplish, we're not going to stay sober. Without a change in our life, none of us is going to make it. And this, my friends, is why alcohol, per se, is so rarely mentioned in the AA program. It is the alcoholism which drives us to the recognition that something is basically wrong with our lives and we have to turn them around. And the AA program is designed to do this. I have a story that many of you have heard me tell before with which I would like to wind up this deathless prose. And even if you haven't heard me tell it, you've heard it many times, because the story of the young man who got impatient with life at home. And he knew he was in his father's will for a substantial portion of the old man's estate, and so he said, I don't want to wait. I'll take my share, whatever you think it should be. I'll be agreeable with me, and I'm going to make my own way in life. And so the father says, all right. You can imagine father of a boy like that has a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. At least according to the storyteller, there was no remonstrance. He just said, here you are. And the boy goes to the big town, and you know what happens. He has a high old time, and he ends up broke. Not only broke, but starving. And he hires out the most degrading kind of work, flopping pigs. Of course, this may not be degrading to people who slop pigs, but it was to the boy who slopped pigs. And suddenly occurred to him that he had been a fool. He said, my inheritance is gone. I haven't any more claims on father, but I'll go back. At least he'll give me a decent job, and I'll eat well and have a clean place to sleep. So he turns around and comes home. Now, you and I, when we've heard this story, have always identified with a kid. Natural. Because this has been our story. But really, the story's about the father. The story says that the father, you can be sure, has been watching this road day in and day out, finally sees the boy in the distance. While he was yet a great way off, he ran out to meet him. Harden let the boy get his carefully rehearsed speech out of his mouth before he threw his arms around him and said, son, you're home. Isn't this what we've all found in AA? We start at home, Our father came out to meet us.